designed to get some of the public to speak to the world of this. Well, actually, Henry was in a lot of different worlds. I made the picture to talk about him at MIT 18 years ago when he was helping on processing controls.
More barn.
Okay, so Henry's going to tell you a little bit about himself. There's so much to say, I don't think you could say it. Let's hear about the legacy of Lisp from Henry Baker.
The first program I worked on in high school was this radiation treatment planning program.
for cancer treatment. And if we just worked out a little bit more on the physics and not as much on the computing, we would have invented the CAT scanning machine. If we were doing exactly the same computation, but we didn't think of that. But it basically did a lot of what we currently would consider to be graphics type of stuff. Did a lot of work, actually paid for my undergraduate school at MIT, by doing what we now call MRP, Material Resource Planning, for a clothing manufacturer. And we took them from the 1950s to the 1990s to the 1970s. The good thing was that their management had no idea what we were doing, so that we were able to get away with it. Done a little bit of discrete simulation software in Fortran at MIT, I've done quite a reasonable amount of hardware considering the background, and then at MIT was doing a lot of stuff with parallel processing, shallow binding, and also garbage collection. What most of you probably think of as working on. I guess my career is roughly coincident with the appearance of transistors commercial processor. So I worked on the first transistor-based machines out of IBM. And it's about 45 years of Moore's Law, and so we're talking about 15 doublings in memory and processing in the 45 years. And that's, I'm not counting the price for these things. I'm just talking about the absolute memory and processing speed. Whatever arguments that people had against LISP in 1970 are infinitely worse today. So in other words, if you have a hard argument, it was much, much worse than in the 1970s. So how come this isn't ubiquitous? I don't really know the answer to that, except that it's just a combination of a lot of things. Just a comment, there appears to be no Moore's Law for software, or at least I think most funding agencies have come to this conclusion. So it's not clear that there's going to be much additional R&D money for anything that you guys might consider to be interesting. So I don't know what's going to happen to computer science research over the next few years. So let's see, incremental software development. I want to talk a little bit about how I think about software development. Not because I think that everybody should do it my way, but this works for me, and maybe it'll resonate with you. You don't start by debugging a blank paper, although that's what a lot of people want to do. The problem with the low hurdle to execution is that people code without thinking, and they end up with this big mass of a program which may actually work under certain conditions, but it's not really a deliverable program. And unfortunately, an awful lot of Lisp seems to have been developed that way. At least Lisp applications have been developed themselves. As I'm putting out here, the computer is a tool to thought, but it doesn't replace the thought. You still got to do the hard thinking about what you're doing. And you got to constantly remember that the computer language has two customers, other people and the machine. And unfortunately, a lot of computer languages are forgotten. They're primarily aimed at either other people or they're aimed at the machine, but it doesn't seem to be a good combination. The way I work, in a lot of cases, I like to prototype the idea, don't even worry about the performance, just try to figure out how the algorithm works. Get some test cases. This is more or less what people are doing now with so-called XP programming style, although people have been doing it for 20 or 30 years and it just didn't have a name. You refine the structure interfaces. You rearrange the code. Sometimes these are very, very substantial rearrangements. You would never recognize, that the two pieces of code were ever even similar. Because you're changing data structures, you're changing changing orders of things, you're doing all kinds of really gross changes to the code. You refine for maintainability and performance. You might start doing some better type checking, doing some serious performance tuning. And at some point, you'd like to make the program, you'd like to convince yourself and other people that the program really, really works in a collective environment. So as time goes on, it does get larger, it gets more annotated, better documented. I think Knuth also talks about this as kind of a literate programming style. The important thing is we want to move smoothly through this sequence. In other words, we don't want to have to change from a specification language to a programming language to an implementation language. So this business of you need a specialized language for each of the steps, in my mind, is complete garbage. It really messes up this evolution of the program. But at the same time, you are going to be making substantial changes. So you have to be able to have editors and systems that can help you do that. And in my mind, throughout my entire career, I've constantly railed against the ability to actually be able to do these changes efficiently and get high productivity doing it. The things that I think should be in there, among the things that are already there, the things that aren't there are you have to be able to change names. I know it sounds silly and I know it sounds stupid, but the first thing that you always end up doing is you program with some initial names, and then eventually you're going to change those names to production names that are going to live in the source code for a long, long time. You have to be able to do that very quickly and with high productivity. I haven't seen a system, and maybe you guys know of some, but I haven't seen a system where you can actually do that in any language, much less Lisp. You have to be able to essentially do beta expansion, which is expand a function inline. Right there. Click on it, boom, it's expanded. Because sometimes you don't actually want the function called. Sometimes you want the result of the function. Sometimes you want a macro, sometimes you want the function. Anyway, these are not incremental character-based changes. These are actually semantic-based changes. And I'm utterly amazed that we're sitting here in 2005 and this stuff doesn't exist. You need to be able to automatically rearrange arguments. You need to be able to change nested continuation passes. You need to be able to do data type substitution. If I want to change the format of my set function, using symbols in a list to using bits in a bit string, that should be very easy to do. And yet, it's very, very hard. And it's utterly amazing to me that people have not worried about that level of thing. This is something that I've dealt with for years, even in, when I was working in industry. You add a field, or you change a field in a record, okay? You want to find every single place in every program that's ever used that field in the record. And here's the hard part, you need to automatically generate a program that's going to go find all the data and fix all of those records as well. Now, I realize that the costs, and people have talked about doing incremental changes, adding things, and lazily changing that stuff. That's not what I'm getting at. I want to be able to do it in a non-lazy fashion. I want to force the thing to get globally fixed, in effect, all at once. The other thing that I think Lisp has actually fallen behind in is this programming in large versus programming in small. You want to be able to use a lot of the same tools for large programs that you use for small programs. And you want to be able to use a lot of the same notions for large and small programs. But that requires that the basic things that you're working on are roughly the same. The truth is that although lambda calculus is in theory infinitely composable and you can build it up any size, the free variables build up non-scalably. You end up with this massive list of free variables. And you saw that in the Lisp machine. There were tens of thousands of concrete names that somebody has to organize and tell you what they are, and you have to have dictionaries of them. It was very, very difficult for a newbie to go to a computer machine and figure out what in the world was going on with all these strange names that were in there. After years and years of Ada and Pascal and Lisp, heavily nested programs with multiple levels of lambdas, there are still no decent ways to edit those and deal with them, and no decent ways of testing. So what you really want to do is unnest everything, test the little programs outside, and then put it all back together and back into this nested form. I just haven't seen the kinds of things that allow people to do that.
But are there any languages that allow you to do that easily?
Ada made an attempt, but it wasn't a very good attempt. The truth is, when C came out, it didn't have nested things, so that basically people stopped even thinking about the problem. So the problem has not really been addressed after Ada. List trivial syntax recursion. These are just my list, so I'm sure there's a lot of additional things you can think of as being list features. Here's one of the main points of my talk today. I think Lisp made a dreadful error at some point back in the 70s. They came to a fork in the road, they took the wrong fork. Instead of going the interlist route, which had the source code was an S expression inside a machine, okay? It was not a list of characters in some file. And in fact, when you edit it, pulled it in, you edit it inside the machine, and then you wrote it. When you wrote it back out, it was just merely for dumping purposes. You weren't actually intending to edit that set of characters that you dumped out into the outside world. You would then read those back in and play around inside the machine again. That actually would have been the right way. I mean, it would have taken inherent advantage of the listness of the list. Instead, somehow Lisp became enamored with this whole character business and storing list programs as a character file. They developed character editors, and they basically took a completely wrong turn. As a result, they ended up with no differentiating advantage over C, Pascal, and the other languages. They were stuck with the same limitations of how you deal with these things. They had no better tools, source code level, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously you can't go back, but it's amazing to me that nobody has, in the last 25 years, reconsidered that decision and moved in that direction. List variables. I'm sorry, John. Fluid variables was a very bad idea. The reason is that the occurrence problem is undecidable. You can never tell whether a variable is ever going to be used or not. And for the vast majority of variables that aren't used inherently as these dynamic binding, that's a real problem. It means that you're inherently limited in how much efficiency you can get out of your compiler, and you're always going to be paying a price for that. Unfortunately, even though a lot of people realized it was a screw-up, the other people didn't realize it was a screw-up, and they copied it anyway. So the APL, MATLAB, huge number of interpreted languages, managed to make what I consider to be the same mistake.
APL was contemporary with Lisp, so yes. If it was a mistake, it was its own mistake.
Your fault.
The other thing is that the forms of binding in Lisp were not my doing. I didn't understand what the problem. never really did understand.
Well, my next one is, nevertheless, it did do a lot in terms of the research environment, because people thought about it a lot. And there are a lot of things that do graphic dynamically. And basically, what people did when they thought about deep binding and shallow binding and all this stuff, they started thinking about other types of things that were similar to that. And it's basically the primary way you do things in undos. So you can basically take any generic tree structured environment and think about it using roughly the same thought pattern. It's exactly what you find in the two-phase transaction protocols and databases. Speculate, commit, roll back. That's all basically shallow and deep binding ideas. But basically, you take a generalization of what we used to do in the Lisp compiler at MIT, and you only instead of storing the old device variable, you store the code to actually redo the thing that you were trying to undo. Exactly the same thing happens in graphic recovery protocol where you're doing the journaling. I mean, that's all journaling is. They're using the same ideas for speculative execution processors. And actually, I was trying to make this precise. I haven't been able to do it. It's actually reminiscent of some of the label swapping stuff that's used in the networking protocol. Lisp has very deep roots in the lambda calculus. Lambda calculus is basically the mathematics of substitution. You take something, a variable, you substitute another thing into that place, you get trees out of that, when you do the substitution. Lambda calculus has three rules: alpha renaming, how you change the bound name of the bound variable; beta reduction, which is basically applying a form to its arguments; and eta reduction, which is, if you look in lambda calculus, you actually have to look pretty hard to find eta reduction, because it's it actually isn't talked about very much, but it's equivalent to tail recursion. And it's actually been proven by the lambda people to be independent of the other axioms. They actually need it as a separate axiom. What's in a name? You don't find out what a name really means unless you try to rename it. So in some sense, that's where the rubber meets the road. In order to rename something, you have to find out only the recurrent occurrences of the name. So you find out what the names won't reflect. Lambda calculus doesn't really care about the spelling of the name, so it only cares which names are the same and different. Interestingly, GC deals with the names at a different level. The pointers has to find the occurrences, and it has to, in the case of copying GC, it has to actually rename all those occurrences. So what are the kinds of names in Lisp? Atom names, keywords, macro names, file names, record names. There's probably even more that I didn't write down here. I guess what I'm arguing here is that you have to be able to find and rename every single one of those kinds of names in order to be, if you're going to have a decent programming environment for this. And I haven't found any of those systems that automatically will do that for me.
Clarification. Can you say one more sentence about why renaming is so important to you?
It's one of the fundamental things you do when you're maintaining a program. You actually have to rename stuff. You might start out renaming, when you first program something, you give it random names like X, Y, Z for argument names. Then but that's not going to be very good for the next guy reading the program. So at some point, somebody actually has to put in decent names that will actually reflect what's going on. And the ability to actually go in and put in high quality names is actually very, very important for maintaining
the language. And you can't have eval at all because you have dynamic names.
What?
You can't have eval at all because then you have dynamic names. Okay, go on.
You can do this mostly. You know, if necessary, you have to do a global search of the entire environment. That's right. But you still have to automate this as much as humanly possible.
say name like variable x.
Yeah.
An x in one function, an x in another function.
Lexical stuffing is all about. It's got to know that. It's got to know all about shadowing. It's got to know all. That's why lexical stuffing is such a good idea. The PL1 compiler, I'm sorry, 1966, 67, would tell me, it would say x colon, and it would give me some, it would actually distinguish all the different versions of x. And it gave me a cross-reference listing where every variable was used. When was the last thing you saw a cross-reference listing for any language in the last 20 years? Yet it's important to be able to understand somebody else's code. You might want to just rename something temporarily, just to put your own name on it, just so you, when in reading somebody's code, you can understand it. During debugging, you have to be able to find all the occurrences. Big maintenance, whenever you make the changes, it's extraordinarily important. When you're importing a program for reuse, you have to change the thing specifically because it's going to apply to something else. This I don't have a good answer for, but I can tell you it's problematic in my opinion. On the Lisp machine, they put in all kinds of long arguments. They put in these and rest arguments. They put in the keyword arguments. Because there were a huge number of arguments. There were optional arguments and stuff. This is a mess. Somebody needs to do another PhD thesis or more. Figure out a really much better way to do this. Because in large-scale systems, you're passing around all kinds of information in very constrained ways. And you need to be able to modify that to later on pass in additional information. And that's the reason why they do the rest arguments and stuff. Nevertheless, it's a very very difficult to understand when you're reading the code. It's very difficult to maintain. It's basically a mess. Sometimes fluid dynamic variables are actually more efficient at passing this information around. Memory management. One of the big successes of Lisp, obviously. Every language up until Lisp, with the exception of IPL, had fixed sizes for things, pre-allocated. That means if you could run out of space in one table, have tons of space in this other table, in a constrained memory environment, it's a terrible thing. Lisp was great. It basically, by allocating it dynamically in small chunks, when you ran out, you were really out of memory. I mean, you had exhausted every single, there wasn't any memory hiding around, unless you somehow managed to build it up in some table and then didn't bother to deallocate it. How does memory management work? It took large expanse of memory allocated in chunks. Dynamically reallocate the chunks when not used. Just this idea of taking long series of stretches of memory and breaking it up into packets, that's a pretty big advance that people, took a long time even in networking for people to realize that was a good thing. So this is a generally, you know, good thing. Now the question is how big should the packets be? Don't want to get into that, but dynamic memory management is a terrific thing. And as the fact that all these other languages, including C sharp and Java and everybody else, is starting to use both dynamic memory management and garbage collection. Yes?
You mentioned that IPL5 had dynamic memory allocation.
Yes. It had a free measure.
It was the earlier IPLs where you had explicit erasure.
Yes. Well, let me distinguish between dynamic memory allocation and then automatic reclamation. Dynamic memory plus additional. So yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's in the same sense that Pascal offered dynamic memory allocation, it did not offer dynamic memory recollection. The combination of those two is extraordinarily powerful feature of Lisp. Everybody says that GC is terrible. There was this wonderful paper a few years ago. I don't know whether Bert did this or somebody Bert knows.
I don't think it was me.
but you were at the conference. Weren't you
Sorry. Yeah, talking about the last point there.
Yeah,
and wasn't that out of symbolics, like David Moon and?
No, it wasn't Moon. This is out of somebody like late 80s, early 90s time frame.
Andrew Appel.
I don't know whether Appel did it, but he was definitely involved in this kind of research. But anyway, if you have a right allocate cache and you have a sequential allocator, and basically you never go to main memory. You talk to the thing, you allocate the thing in cache. Use it in the cache. Most of the time, you stop using it, and then the cache mechanism itself, in effect, kicks it out. It never involves any interface with main memory. Guess what? It's just as efficient as a register. That is very, very cool. And most people don't understand that. They think, oh my God, garbage box. It's a terrible thing. And I think most people react negatively to garbage collection because they looked at things like the list machine, which was basically paging itself to death because it didn't have enough main memory. You know, it really didn't run well until it had about 8 megawords of memory, and most of the machines shipped with about 2 megawords of memory. It just left a bad taste in a lot of people's minds. Here's an opportunity that I think Lisp missed, some ability to do real-time memory management. Exactly the same thing you do with memory. You break time up into discrete chunks. You don't have unbounded stretches of an uninterrupted execution. You allocate and deallocate these things. Why do you say you need deallocation? It's because you speculate with these things. You think you're going to need something, and then the if then else goes the other way, you don't need it anymore. Anyway, that's a TBD. Nobody wants to follow up on that. Efficiency matters. I can't tell you the number of list people I've talked to that just have no conception of efficiency. When the list machine first turned on their serial port, it would only run at the 4K baud. Couldn't even run the speed of a printer. And the reason was it was sending something like 100 function calls for every character. It was so generic. Yeah, it was so generic that, you know, didn't get the job done. I'm sorry, but the customers, they didn't care. Don't run my modem at a decent speed. The problem with Lisp is it's just too easy for a new programmer to write just terribly inefficient code. And not only that, the books that you buy that talk about it, a lot of books, gave such awful, awful examples about how you did things that, you know, it just left the impression in so many people's minds that you could not, you know, write fast programs. And that's, as we all know in this room, that's actually wrong, but I'm sure we're the only ones who know it. At the same time, not only was it too easy to write bad code, it was also too hard to write good code. I think it's a testament to Lin Kwong. He was one of the early users of the symbolic machine, and he pushed us really hard on exactly some of the surface things that he was talking about in his talk. The truth is, we had to go to a lot of trouble to support that, and that's a problem. In other words, why wasn't that already built into the language in some sense? I haven't seen very many profilers of Lisp. I'm sure Franz might have one, but generally, back in the 70s and early 80s, nobody cared about things like profiling. Yes.
It's a sad permanent fact that the most elegant versions of functions are inefficient. And it goes back well before computing. Namely, if you take the definition of Fibonacci numbers and you try to compute them that way, then that exponential expansion of the computing process.
Yes, but there are clever things that you can do. For example, in the case of Fibonacci, or in the case of piano or Fibonacci numbers, all you have to do is memoize it, and it runs Just spot them.
Do what?
Memoize them.
Memoize them.
Cache the results, and it runs just fine. And I've used that. It's a very effective generic mechanism for speeding stuff up, as long as it's afflictive. And why isn't that built into the list? I don't know, because it's not a list. It's mostly not afflictive to my part.
Sure, the Firefox is not part.
I understand that it is. Memoization is built into Maple, but not into Maximal, which is sad because there's no reason why Maximal couldn't be used. Everybody's faced this. You take the standard off-the-shelf code, the suggested function for doing something in a list book, you run it, and it's too slow. So now what do you do? Okay? Well, what you'd like to do is fix it without having to change your code, right? Because if you change your code, all it's going to do is fix your code. It's never going to make that any faster for anybody else. Lisp hasn't fixed that either. There's got to be a way to be able to go back into the environment and make those things better.
Maybe there is one, but I don't think there's a systematic way of making things efficient. For example, if you take the Lisp reverse function that reverses a list, the most efficient reverse is very dirty because it does refocus.
Use Telegram.
Well, maybe.
That uses linear stack space.
So what?
You're basically duplicating the list.
No, it's just a loop. Anyway, we'll handle that one.
You think there is a systematic way in which...
The vast majority of things that people complain about in Lisp, there are very, very simple answers to. It's just that they aren't in the books that most of the people that have access to them get to see.
How that will expand.
Anyway, part of the problem here is that people are fiddling with this and didn't care about efficiency. And that was more than just an oversight. They literally didn't want to work on things that would be efficient. In other words, that was not in their space of things they wanted to think about. So it's actually a cultural problem. Why didn't somebody come up with a type checking package in Lisp? It would have been trivial. It would have answered all the complaints that people had about this lack of types. For some reason, somebody at Carnegie or some of these places convinced DARPA that you couldn't write real programs in Lisp because there was no types. From then on, this whole mystique of, type checking is, that's for serious programmers, not for it's not a big deal. It's very easy to put fragments of type systems into the list and type checks and stuff. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by type checking and what it is that you don't think?
Put in ML types, put in C types, whatever your favorite type system is. Put in those fragments and run the type check on your program. Just exactly the way they do it in C or PL1 or Pascal or any of your favorite type check
models. Static type check.
Static type check.
But without compilation, it just.
Yeah. It doesn't solve every possible problem. Any system is valid on a type check, but it would certainly solve exactly the same set of problems that the people that were, arguing with DARPA that they needed to develop ADA. Do exactly the same set of things. Anyway, there is another good reason for doing it. Even if you never want to actually implement a type system, just the idea of trying to type it tells you a tremendous amount of information about what makes a good interface to a function, what types, just for the programmer to think about. And the recombinant system is riddled with functions that have really strange types for their functions. In my opinion, you know, that should be fixed. They just don't deserve to be that way. There's another problem with Lisp, but in effect, it became a dead language the moment the Commonwealth Manual came out. It basically halted Lisp innovation. At that point, everybody focused on trying to meet the standard, and then from then on, any changes outside the standard were looked at very much askance. And you know, Lisp had prior to that been a tremendous source of new ideas and new things, that just killed it. You know, the good ideas went somewhere else. You know, that's why you see things like sandboxing and loaders in Java. You don't see them in Lisp. You know, there's no reason why that stuff isn't done in Lisp. I'll just run down the list. I don't know who got the idea that you have to do bit hacking. You always have to do bit hacking. Computers do. And for some reason, the implementers of Common Lisp didn't want to make it very easy for you to do that. We've been arguing about immutable list cells and strings for ages. Just do it. Enough, though. Enough already. I mean, Common Lisp, you know, made a mistake, was committed, and fixed it. I've written a number of papers about linear variables. These are great things. I mean, this is kind of like peeling back. This is like decomposing an atom in physics. It's unbinding, you know, the quarks, you know, inside of an atom. Even if you don't care about linear variables yourself, you do care about them at the level of system programming. You're going to need them if you're going to do things efficiently.
What are linear variables?
There are things that, the easiest way to describe it is they have one occurrence in their scope. Use it, it's dead. Okay?
The reference count is always one, is that the same, basically?
4-0.
So, and I understand that the...
ACL2 has what we call single-threaded objects, which are like...
They're kind of approximations.
Yeah, they allow us to execute destructive assignments without the use of them.
This next one, microkernel with a reflective port. Anybody who's actually implemented Lisp, especially Common Lisp, the language, realizes it's an enormous thing. You want 99.44% of that to be in Lisp. You want absolute. You'd like, if at all possible, the implementation of Lisp to consist of, you know, a couple of pages of microkernel kind of code necessary to actually talk to the bare hardware. But there is no reason on earth why, some effort to be able to figure out how to do that. All the Lisp systems, they just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger throughout the 70s and 80s. I mean, even Mac was enormous.
Yeah, it was 10.
And it's most all written in assembly.
Yeah, all written in assembly.
And that's just wrong. It's not the way you build a large-scale system. You just don't get any of the benefits. You don't get any leverage. You know, programming Lisp is a hell of a lot more productive than programming in assembly language. So you want to make as much of the Lisp part and as little of the other stuff. Lisp just never got into this real-time business. It's amazing. That's where all the action has been for a long time, and they just never got into it. They never developed a persistent DB. I mean, I'm really glad to see the Allegro thing, but my God, this is 25 years too late.
Didn't AT&T do some real-time switching work?
They may have tried, but I mean, you know, they didn't have much help from the theoretical community, the academic community, to build, you know. I think the current is a better integrated with threads and new parallel processors. The current Lisp is so heavily embodied, very close coupled, shared memory, cache coherent. That stuff is just too expensive. You know, guys, got to come up with stuff that's a lot easier. I know Bert's worried about this in the past. And part of it has to do with the fact that the con cells are small, strings are mutable. I mean, you got to make stuff a lot more applicative, and you focus your attention for the non-mutable stuff, for the mutable stuff, to the things that really do have to be mutable, because that's going to be really heavy weight. It takes a lot of effort to deal with something mutable. It has to be protected. It has to have some force around it. There's all kinds of problems. Yeah. Some of the things that Liz did write. It didn't become the operating system. Why are we trying to integrate with C, for God's sake? Yeah. It should be the other way around. This is pure C ink, okay? So when the virus comes in, they deal with C, with this, they're not going to get it. They deal with C, that's where the problem starts. So the world is upside down.
Well, there are two kinds of uses of C. One is trying to use pre-existing libraries. Now, the other is to enhance performance of Lisp systems using what C does well, or number crunching or whatever.
This is a whole list of stuff.
You've got to give us a slide.
Yes, I will. I have an agenda. Obviously, Lisp is looking at XML. anyway, basically my last slide. You get two choices here. You either go to Masada or you go to China. China's where all the action is. Masada's where people go to commit suicide. So.